You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, November 2nd, 2015. I'm Michael Brooks. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Professor Juan Cole of Informed Comment Blog. We're talking about why Turkey's Ben Carson, or as you know him, President Erdogan, won big yesterday's elections in Turkey. New developments in Syria, President Obama sending special forces as Russia amplifies his actions in the region, and how the Turkish elections connect to it. Also, comedian Chris Hamilton. We're going to be talking about the future of comedy and getting another perspective on PC culture on college campuses and stand-up. We'll have a brief chat together. And we got a whole lot more. News from Bangladesh, where a secularist publisher was hacked to death by terrorists. Also, Paul Ryan. We'll hear more about his stunning hypocrisy as he takes the helm as Speaker of the House right out of the gate with utter nonsense. And Hillary Clinton's campaign and those associated with her have been accusing Bernie Sanders of sexism. And I have a lot to say about that, which I will get to in the fun half. Obviously, Sam not here today. This is the first day where it's just myself and the new producers, New Matt and Classic Kelly. How are you guys doing? Turn yourself up, buddy.
I'm very well.
Matt is very well.
I'm great.
Classic Kelly's great. Everybody had a fun weekend, fun Halloween weekend. I was lame. I didn't dress up. I went to a party, and I had the most, like, just, it was pathetic how weak my costume was. I didn't have time to put anything together, so I did that, like, burglar BS. You know what I mean? It was disgusting. I was disgusted with myself. And it occurred to me right after I left, and I would have no time to put this together, that if I got the wig and like an Adidas tracksuit, I could have been Sex Machine Bernie Sanders, which would have been a great character but and an outfit. But no, alas.
I had a great costume. I got really dressed up, and I wasn't going anywhere, though. I just stayed home.
What were you?
I was Courtney Love in the 90s.
I could see that.
Yeah. It's something I just like to do sometimes.
You're a Courtney Love chick.
Yep.
Totally.
Yep.
That's awesome. What did you do, new Matt?
I was a bar hopper for Halloween, which meant I just went to a bar with some friends, and we were all bar hoppers. It was really convincing.
Every problem that you need to know about Brooklyn was just encapsulated in those two answers, folks. It's a lot of problems here. All right, folks, we're going to take a brief break. Yeah, go ahead, Kelly.
I just want to make it clear that I wasn't on drugs. I was just only in the outfit. It's the outfits I go for, not the heroin and whatever else. Thank
it's
you.
The outfits, not the heroin. That's what you had on the top of your resume,
yeah.
Actually.
I'm not a fan of heroin. I don't really know, no.
You're not a fan of heroin?
No, nope.
Okay. All right, yeah, that sounds fair. Neither are we. We're going to be right back with Professor Juan Cole. I'll ask him what his feelings on heroin are. We'll be back in about 40 seconds on today's Majority Report. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be right back.
When they kick out your front door, how you gonna come? With your hands on your head or on the trigger of your gun? When the law breaks in, how you gonna go? Shut down on the pavement or waiting on death row? You can crush us, you can bruise us, but you'll have to answer too. Oh, guns of Brixton. When the money seems good and your life you like it well, but surely your time will come.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Professor Juan Cole, the proprietor of Informed Comment blog, professor at the University of Michigan, and author of the new book, The New Arabs. Professor, how are you? Thank you so much for joining us.
Just fine, thank you.
So I want to start by talking about the results of yesterday's elections in Turkey, and I think this is an interesting touch point for us to have this conversation. I remember, actually, I think it was two summers ago, one of the first times I was hosting the Majority Report, in fact, you and I talked about the Gezi Square protests and this sort of emerging coalition on the left in Turkey to rein in Erdogan, prime minister then, president now. And it seemed like several months ago in regional elections that that there was going to be a check on his AKP government. But yesterday, that did not hold up, and they won a very convincing victory. So we'll get into more details, but first, just sort of run us through the results and your kind of basic takeaway of what happened yesterday.
Well, there's some dissatisfaction with the Justice and Development Party that's headed by Tayyip Erdogan. Mm-hmm. It's been winning elections since 2002 and winning majorities since then, except, as you note, last June 7th, where they came in with only 42% of the seats. So when a party in a parliamentary system rules for that long, there are always some discontents. And obviously, even this time, they didn't quite get to 50%, but they got it close enough to 50% that they can form a government without a partner.
Right.
So, you know, there are half the country won't vote for them, feels that they're somewhat high-handed and have moved away from some of their original promises about pluralism. But they have a lot of support in the center of the country, basically. Their heartland supporters came out in big numbers, concerned in part about security, and handed them this victory through 2019.
Yeah, and we'll get to the security questions, but I think it's always important. I think, and I know you and I have covered a bit of this ground before, but you mentioned that there's a contrast in his present leadership with some of the promises that the Justice and Development Party, or AKP, made around pluralism when they first came to office, which I believe was in 2002, and that basically, when this party first came into office, it was sort of, you know, it wouldn't be the party that I would vote for necessarily. I'm a pretty left-wing guy and not particularly enamored of religious politics, but it was important because it was sort of an Islamic version of a Christian Democratic Party in Europe. And paradoxically, even though it was a kind of right-leaning religious party, it was a progressive force in Turkish domestic politics when it first came into office. Now, it seems like, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, though, that Erdogan, and it's fair to talk really specifically about him as a personality because his sort of stamp on the party is quite strong and quite clear. There's certainly no real rival to him. That it seems like there this sort of discourse about democracy and this discourse about pluralism was not internalized from the beginning. And it seems like this might be a, what's happened more recently is maybe more of a revelation of what the real project has been with him and the AKP government. I mean, do you think that's fair? You did call him the Ben Carson type figure recently.
Well, he started talking rather erratically and doing erratic things. He maintained in this election that one of his rival parties, the People's Democratic Party, which is pro-Kurdish,
right,
that its campaign was being run by Obama's campaign team. So apparently David Axelrod has taken up residence in Diyarbakir. I mean, it's just crazy stuff that he says sometimes.
Right.
And then he's developed this Napoleonic complex. He built this enormous presidential palace with 100 rooms, and he has this palace guard with representatives of what he calls the 16 Turkic civilizations. Dressed in medieval style that stand behind him.
And, I did that so in my apartment recently, but I wouldn't overly read into it.
Yeah. This kind of grandiosity, right, to it. And then, you know, he basically started talking as though Turkey is an elective dictatorship. That is, right, to say, people have democracy to the extent that they can go to the polls and choose him. But then after that, they should sit down and be quiet. That ongoing protest or petition or political activity, criticism of him and so forth is unwelcome. That it's just you can vote and then let him run things. And this this kind of is not unheard of in the United States, but this kind of attitude is pernicious to democracy.
Right, and I think the next question to get to that's important is this, because there is this sort of conversation in the United States about Islam and democracy and, you know, conspiracies about Islam. It seems to me, I mean, is this the course he's taken? Is that showing the sort of incompatibility of Islamic politics with democratic politics, which would be some people's interpretation, or is he really just reflecting a more traditional sort of specific problem to Turkey, which has also happened under secular leaders, which is a kind of electoral dictatorship, as you call it, or just a sort of strongman conspiratorial politics?
Yeah, I should underline that so far he hasn't done very much that's specifically Islamic.
Right.
He does have a constituency among believing Muslims, and obviously that's where his heart lies. And he does have a rhetoric of Muslim politics. But if you look at the legislative agenda of his party up until this point, and who knows what will happen in the future, it's really more center-right policies than anything else. And he hasn't, pursued a lot of the kind of cultural politics or lifestyle issues. They did make a law that you can't buy liquor after 10 p.m. from a liquor store. You can still get it in restaurants after that. And when there was protest about it, he said, well, you know, if you're an alcoholic, go buy it beforehand and drink it at home. Then there's been debates about restricting abortion. So there's at the edges, some of that kind of thing. But actually, his party at the national level so far has enacted less in the way of legislation in support of religion, I would say, than has the Republican Party in the United States.
Right. And so moving into these security questions, if we go to another area where he sort of reversed himself in a really unfortunate way, he actually made some real progress with sort of soothing relations with the Kurds, and he gave some sort of expanded civil rights for the Kurdish population. He negotiated with armed Kurdish groups. Recently, that's been reversed entirely, and now there's, the PKK is engaging in terrorism again. The Turkish state is sort of drawing a direct equivalency between ISIL and the Kurdish fighters. And it seemed like in the same way that maybe he was reverting to type in many other ways as a kind of traditional Turkish leader, he was using the Kurdish issue as a wedge issue in the campaign and to kind of stoke nationalism. And I'm just wondering, with the results of this election, I mean, where do you see that dynamic going?
Right. So I think your description of it is accurate. I was in Ankara a couple of weeks ago. It was soon after the October 10 bombing of the Kurdish pro-Kurdish peace rally.
Could you explain that bombing just a bit? Because it was horrific, but it kind of passed very quickly here in the United States.
Yeah, well, it was 102 people were killed and many more wounded. And I met people who had just come back from funerals of their or commemorations of their dead friends. So it was a big shock. We didn't have any bombings of this magnitude in Turkey. It's being blamed by the government on ISIL. It is true that ISIL and the Kurds have a big fight because the ISIL territory in Syria includes Raqqa province, with the northern part of which is largely Kurdish. And the Kurds in the north have fought ISIL off and humiliated it. So the argument is that an ISIL cell in Diyarbakir in eastern Turkey took revenge with this bombing, and another one earlier at Sirte. But people on the left in Ankara are very suspicious of this government story about it, and there are dark conspiracies that somebody else was behind it, possibly even some force within the Turkish government. I'm not alleging this. I'm simply reporting the gossip that was going around Ankara.
Right.
So in any case, obviously the Kurds were targeted in this bombing. But the general Turkish public outside of Ankara seems to have taken this and other incidents, because there have been 150 Turkish soldiers or police killed and 30 civilians by the more extreme PKK, right, Kurdish movement. They've taken this as a sign that the country faces security challenges. And who better to solve Turkey's security challenges than Tayyip Erdogan?
Right.
So he seems to have picked up that extra 8% this time from people who were worried about security or worried about a kind of Turkish nationalism. He seems to have taken votes away from a secular kind of extreme nationalist party. And then he picked up back up some support from conservative Kurds, and that was, they had been part of his coalition because they're religious and vote culture rather than ethnicity. But in June 7th, the conservative Kurds, many of them had voted for a left wing pro Kurdish party. So they switched around their priorities this time.
Right. And this is actually a good question that will start to transition us into Syria. One of the paradoxes and another reversal with this Turkish government was that when they came into office, they talked about having a zero problems with neighbors foreign policy and a synchronized foreign policy, where they could basically, under the leadership of Erdogan and the Justice Development Party, they could, you know, maintain great relations with the West, in fact, move closer to the West by joining the European Union, which was a goal of theirs, but also reestablish more presence across the greater Arab Middle East, maintain cordial relations with Iran and Syria. Clearly, over the last several years, that really shifted, and Turkey saw an opportunity, apparently, to establish itself in a different way outside of the sort of Arab uprisings in 2011, and the prime point for their influence and interference has been in Syria. And, you know, with some, again, this is another sort of, you know, alleged thing, but people go around a lot in Turkey with even people charging the AKP government, the Justice and Development government, with actually supporting ISIL, or certainly not being concerned about really extremist Sunni groups operating in Syria and potentially taking over. Is there a possibility, in light of the security problems that are coming back into Turkey, as well as, you know, now we have U.S. special forces coming on the ground, all of a sudden our two NATO allies going to be on the opposite sides of a proxy war in some indirect sense, Russia obviously there as well, is this a time where Turkey might think about dialing it back and moving to a more, you know, conciliatory posture, if that's possible, in its regional relations in Syria, or are they going to stay the course?
Oh, I think that Erdogan got his majority in parliament, so he's going to continue with his foreign policy projects. I don't see his policies in Syria as so much opportunistic as they are reactions to the events there. You know, he came to power on the back of support from small-town Sunni Muslims. Mm-hmm. And the small-town Sunni Muslims in central Turkey are not very different from the ones just south in Syria. They speak Turkish rather than Arabic, but so what?
Right.
So the civil war, the youth revolution in Syria began in 2011. Bashar al-Assad crushed it with tanks and artillery and sniping, and then it turned into a civil war when outraged Syrian Sunnis in the center of the country took up arms. And those are Erdogan's people who took up arms. He had tried to cultivate Bashar al-Assad, and they went on vacation together, and they had good relations. He didn't care that al-Assad is a secular Ba'athist. But when the Syrian government attacked these relatively peaceful protesters and drove them to take up arms, Erdogan had to make a choice. Is he going to let that stand, or is he going to fight back against it? And I think that it wasn't an option for him to let it stand, because people in Turkey who were very similar to the ones that were being killed by the Syrian government wouldn't have stood for it. That's his constituency. That's part of what's going on. Then the other thing was the Iranians are supporting, you know, came in and became big supporters of the Ba'ath Party in Syria. And so, you know, Turkey had viewed Syria as a potential kind of economic satellite. It started doing a lot more trade with it. And so not only were Sunnis being killed, but now it was becoming an Iranian sphere of influence. So I think these were the kinds of considerations that led Erdogan to, back certain forces in Syria. And the best fighters are Salafi, hardline Sunnis. And although that's not, I think, Erdogan's cup of tea, as a pragmatic matter, he finally decided to make an alliance with the Saudis and to back the Salafis. And the Salafis shade off at the edges into al-Qaeda, which, is disturbing. But again, from a pragmatic point of view, if they're good at killing Syrian soldiers, then you have no choice but to wink at that. So the U.S. has a completely different point of view on all this. And they, you know, that's a red line for them, al-Qaeda or ISIL or something. And they've taken up with the leftist Kurds in Syria as their best infantry proxy, and that drives Erdogan up the wall. He's very upset about that.
Right. That's a really important point to underline, and it's not in any way a justification, obviously. But when we go back even back into the 1980s and talk about funding the Mujahideen and why Pakistan and Saudi Arabia would put you know, resources and weapons and money into the hands of the most radical and the most militant and the most extreme of the Mujahideen. Maybe in some, I mean, certainly some ideological affinity in some respects, but the main reason was the perception, and apparently often the accurate perception, that those were the best fighters. So it's a similar dynamic in Syria. And I guess, you know, now we're seeing moves in Syria to, you know, the U.S. has invited Iran into negotiations. Clearly the U.S. has somewhat softened its position, at least rhetorically, around Assad and whether or not he needs to go. But it seems like, just as you described with Turkey, in fact, within Turkey's sort of narrow and understandable sense of self-interest, even just going back to Erdogan protecting his constituency in some respects, everybody inside this conflict is sort of acting from a place that is, you know, quite understandable and rational within its context. Iran, in terms of expanding its influence, having a bridge into Lebanon, you know, the Gulf states wanting to dislodge Assad, Russia backing Assad. From that context, and in this really disastrous situation, which appears to have no ready solution, I mean, what could possibly come out of new talks and diplomatic engagement when everything is so sort of locked in and preset? Is there any kind of path here?
Yeah, in my view, the most likely end to this civil war is a victory by somebody.
Mm.
But there have been situations in which these conflicts have ended without a victory, and not necessarily satisfactorily. But I lived in Lebanon in the early years of the civil war there, which lasted from 1975 to 1989. And by the way, that's typical of insurgencies of this sort. Once they get started, they seem to go about 15 years on average. My own unscientific analysis of what happened in Lebanon was that the various factions once formed fought each other until it became clear that the next battle was not going to bring them any benefit. And then the big leaders were enticed to tie up in Saudi Arabia under Saudi patronage and made a peace deal with one another, which has more or less held ever since. You could argue that it produced a certain amount of gridlock in the settlement in Lebanese politics. It's not as if there's a strong government or an effective one, but mostly people have not taken back up arms, even under severe strains such as we're seeing now because of the fallout over Syria. And then they did make an exception for Hezbollah in the south, the Shiite militia, which they have appointed a kind of national guard to guard the south against Israeli incursions. And that, you know, has morphed now into a kind of regional militia that's willing to strike into Syria.
Right.
You could imagine a situation in which, not now, but down the road, Sunni and Alawite and Baath and other leaders and Kurdish, so forth from Syria, sat at a table somewhere in the Gulf or Moscow or someplace and made a set of commitments to disarm and to go forward. And so that's the best outcome you could hope for from these multi-party talks. But it's not going to happen right now because the people on the ground haven't come to that decision that I mentioned that occurred in Lebanon, where the next battle is not going to bring any more benefit. They still think they can win.
My final question then is, I'm reminded of a piece a couple years ago that the former South African president Thabo Mbeki wrote, and I think it was also he did an interview on Al Jazeera where he sort of, his argument was that the problem is that the Western focus is on justice, which he would probably put in air quotes, before peace. so that when we fixate on someone like Assad, who undoubtedly is a butcher and a horrific human rights violator, and we sort of go towards, well, he just needs to go, we misread the larger situation and conflict, and then we miss an opportunity to start having the type of conversation earlier that you're talking about. Now, obviously, he could be wrong. So my question is, I mean, was it a mistake to say Assad needed to go? Or, on the other hand, is it in fact a precondition for the type of process you're talking about?
The issue with Assad is that President Obama demanded that he step down in sort of May of 2011, and I think Obama did this more than once, and he did it with Yemen too. And I personally disagreed with him on this policy. I don't think you should demand that somebody step down if you're the president of the United States, unless you can make them.
Right.
Because then they don't step down and you look weak. And, you know, Bush Sr. made this mistake with Saddam. And so I think it's all along a mistake to put out these kind of toothless ultimatums. And with regard to the negotiations, now the Obama administration, as you say, has revised its position and maintains that the talks can go forward towards elections without Assad stepping down. And, you know, if only Assad had had elections in 2011, we could have avoided this massive tragedy which has affected the entire world. And now it's late. I mean, how would you hold elections in a condition of civil war? But sooner or later, it may be possible to start holding them. And that's one of the ways you could see going forward, if Syria became more of a federal state, so that there was more states' rights and regional autonomy, and the strong, you know, Sunni areas could elect strong Sunni representatives to the Syrian parliament, and the Alawites could elect their delegates, and then they can all wrangle with each other and trade horses in parliament rather than duking it out with medium weaponry in the streets.
Right.
That's a possible end game here. But and that's another thing that, you know, the Russians have suggested, they go to elections as early as next summer. One doesn't know the future. It seems to me early, but sooner or later, you may be able to get buy-in to such a plan. But, you know, the problem is that the Ba'ath party that Bashar al-Assad heads is a one-party state and very manipulative and grasping. And they're like the old Stalinists. And people are afraid that, you know, they'll have show elections the way they have had a number of elections, you know, in Syria. But they've all been for show. And the Ba'athis managed to control everything. They have a secret police. They arrest people in the middle of the night. They, you know, they've tortured 10,000 people to death.
Yeah.
Torturing 10,000 people to death is excessive. These are people who were already in custody. They were harmless at that point, and they were nevertheless tortured to death. So this is, you know, to hope that such a regime can preside over dispassionate elections is a little bit hope too far. But you know, maybe steps can start being made in that direction. My guess is this goes on for another 10 years, and my best guess is that there's a military victory at the end of it by somebody.
Okay.
But you can't rule out the other possibility, which is to have some kind of civil society process that produces compromises and people start laying down their guns.
Well, Professor Juan Cole, we'll have to leave it at that. I really appreciate your time. And that's also quite a takeaway line, that torturing 10,000 people to death is excessive. That says a lot about what's happening in Syria today. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you.
All right, folks. We will be right back with Christopher Hamilton. We'll talk to him for a few minutes. But before we do that, I got to tell you about today's sponsor. And that is trunkclub.com. New Matt, do you like to go shopping?
When I need to. I'd rather
do you like to go clothes shopping?
I'd rather somebody just sent me something, though.
Well, you are in luck. That was a very, very elegant transition there, buddy. Everybody knows that shopping is awful. And I can't deal with it. I can't do crowded stores. I can't go in there, try on 10 pairs of pants. Who knows if they're even going to fit. Maybe if you have a girlfriend, you can get her to go with you a couple of times and she's kind of into it. And then after like three or four times, she's just like, dude, get your life together. Stop relying on me for this. It's not a good look, right, Kelly? She's saying yeah. She doesn't want to somehow say that publicly for some reason. But you know, here's the problem. You still want to look great, right? Right, new Matt?
Right.
Way to sell it, buddy. All right. You still want to look great. And with Trunk Club, you never have to set foot in the mall again, which is amazing, okay? Trunk Club takes the hassle out of shopping by shipping you, just as you asked for, new Matt, a trunk of clothes that fit perfectly and make you look like $1 million with all the new fall styles. At trunkclub.com/majority, you answer a simple questions about your style, preference, sizes, and you're assigned an expert stylist. This is like style for the people. They curate your clothes from the best premium brands, and you prove what you like. And just like that, a trunk arrives at your doorstep filled with handpicked clothes that are perfect for you. Try them on, keep what you like, and easily return what you don't like in their prepaid trunk. So you don't even need to keep all of it. They're going to send it to you, new Matt. You're going to go through it with your discerning eye. You could be listening to some Kennedy archive tapes while you do it. And then you just pick what you want. Would you go for this classic, Kelly?
I think it's a great idea.
Isn't it? It's amazing. This is not a subscription service. You only have to pay for the clothes you keep from the trunk. No hidden charges, just great clothes. And right now, their entire styling service is free. Even the shipping. You only pay for the clothes you keep. Take advantage. Go to trunkclub.com/majority. That's trunkclub.com/majority. And go there and get a trunk filled with clothes you'll love wearing. We also have a link on our website. We'll be right back with Christopher Hamilton on...
And it's a protege, eh? Yeah. Chronics are where you say, eh? When me see Jah, me see a way. Drastically straight from hypocrisy, I say, hey. Every man to them own a philosophy. I live the proper way and then me read a chapter daily. Monday in a city hungry and no eat. And food they down a country does a drop off of the tree then. You see say poverty no real then. Is what the reason it revealing. I'm pleased to be chilling in the West Indies. I provide all my wants and needs. I got the sunshine, rivers and trees. Relief, yeah.
When the rain hits a pot on the roof, herb just a steam pepper pot on the stew. Life is a dream if you got gratitude. So go tell the regime them can't stop where we do now. Information you think on your own, or else you're a slave to the things that you know. What do you know if you learn every day? So be careful of things where you say.
Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? I just go where the trading blows, sending love to my friends and foes. And I suppose I'm pleased to be chilling in the West Indies. I provide all my wants and needs.
once we eye and I gather. If we cannot show now a balance that we had, how do we propose then to carry it abroad? Can I go to Ethiopia and you not have a plan? The building of a nation and a helper on every...
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. New Matt, just the transformation that came over him when that Protege and Chronix track came on was amazing. You ever listen to music like that in the Dakotas?
Yeah, we are all about that music in the Dakotas.
Okay. Joining us now is my friend Christopher Hamilton. He's a professional stand-up comedian based right here in New York City. Chris, how you doing?
I'm doing all right, man. I'm good.
It's great to be talking with you. I wanted to just get you on for a couple of minutes because you and I were on a panel last week and we were hanging out and we were talking about this, basically this conversation that keeps coming up again and again and again about doing stand-up in colleges and like the changing nature of stand-up comedy and PC and not PC and all this stuff. And I realized I talked with a writer about this about a month ago and got his perspective, but I wanted the perspective of an actual real life and very funny comedian. So I'm just wondering,
cool.
Like,
thank you. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. So what my kind of like base question for you is, do you feel like when you go out and like, are you noticing audiences changing? Basically, that's the my first and most basic question.
Yeah. From when I started comedy to like what I'm seeing now is that their asses are tighter. Can I curse? Is that a possibility?
You can white people curse.
Okay. Yeah. No problem. I can do that.
I think you know what I'm saying. Yeah.
They're tightening up and it's weird because I can say one word and that can tighten up the whole crowd. I can just switch that word around to say man or woman. And depending on which one I say, depending on the story or the joke, I'm like, oh, I can take that. Like if I talk about a guy getting sexually assaulted by another man, we're willing to laugh about that. But if I say that about a woman, we're like, oh, that's too close to home. But yeah, right. They're both very close to home because they're both men and women. But we accept other things rather than certain things. But yeah, it's definitely weird.
And do you think, what we were trying to sort of define is that there's obviously like this part of that that's really positive because you're having a more active conversation to take on things like sexism, homophobia, racism, all of that. But the danger that you were telling me about, which I thought was interesting, which I guess other people have mentioned, but I like the way you put it, that what you're starting to do is you're getting robbed of the ability to really point out how horrifying and messed up things can be because you can't go to those places because people get locked and frozen around certain words. Is that right? And could you tell me more about that?
Yeah, no, you're completely right. There's buzzwords. I think like marketing, we have buzzwords that we say free and amazing. Go, oh, that's free and amazing.
Right.
I can do a joke where I happen to say a word that might not even be about the joke. It just might be a word that I use. And already the crowd will go, oh, it's a word we shouldn't like. And that's what will happen. I can't talk about Caitlyn Jenner, you know? And if I do, I have to appreciate her and say all these wonderful things, even though I might not even be discrediting her. I say her name and everybody's going to be like, oh, I can't believe she just mentioned that. Even though we're both, as a comic, our job is to be able to talk about whatever under the sun. You know what I mean? So that way it can open up to the world and other people to say the same exact things or at least open up a conversation. If I can't say anything, then it's going to be harder for other people to say things because I'm trying to say it as a funny person. I'm not just trying to say it to make somebody angry. There's no evil agenda. It's just me trying to make you laugh. Now, if you go, oh, I don't even want to laugh at that, then you're saying that there is a side that is better. There's a lot of stuff that goes into it if you stop people from saying certain things. If I can't joke about Jews, then you're saying something.
Hold on.
There's a problem there.
Watch yourself.
Yeah, right? Yeah, right.
Yeah.
My cousin uncle is a Jew. I can't.
Is there a role because on the other hand, it seems like there's this other extreme where and you know, the reason we're talking about this is because it's not necessarily in the headlines always, but it sort of like becomes these conversations, like something weird like Gamergate, which, you know, most people are not paying attention to. But if you check almost like any online forum that people are spending hours a day on, or any number of podcasts, like I listen to Joe Rogan's podcast and I like his podcast. He talks about this stuff constantly, to the point of almost like, it almost seems like he thinks that there's some sort of like cultural emergency about this stuff that I don't think most people actually see or experience. And I guess what's the balance between your first and primary role, which is to be funny, and then like the role of saying, I want to be, you know, like an empathetic human being. Does that even have any role in comedy? Is that totally irrelevant? Or is that something you're trying to navigate and figure out how to bring together in your process of doing stand-up?
My job is to be the funniest I can be.
Yeah.
That's what I do.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try to get there the best way I can. I want people to agree with me when I'm doing it. You know what I mean? But I also want to enlighten them.
Right.
If there's a lot of people, black people get killed in America all the time. How many jokes do you see that on TV? There's no jokes.
Right.
But there should be, because we have to talk about it. If you don't talk about it, yeah, it doesn't happen. It's just going to keep on happening. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But that's political correctness. Political correctness, I don't want to offend cops or black people. But, all right, well, who are you going to kill? Which one's worse? Are you really going to say, oh, I don't want to make you feel ashamed for 5 seconds? Or are you going to just let black people kill you and kill? That's a political correctness. Political correctness is just lazy liberals. Lazy liberals who say, nope, I did my job. I complained.
I take a lot of runs, Chris. So, excuse me. No lazy liberal here. No, I'm just playing. Yeah. You know, that's actually okay. So that's, but it seems like, and we'll wrap this up in a minute, but I think it's really interesting because I feel like you're almost, because some people define political correctness as, I think, you know, a pretty honorable thing, which is that you don't want to say, you don't want to just trash people because of who they are, right? And then there's this kind of like lazy, like Howard Stern kind of knockoff, you know, just like any hack comedian in the circuit who comes up and is just like, hey, you know, fuck, you know, gay people, whatever, right? And it's lazy and it's boring. And look, everybody on a free speech level, everybody can say and do whatever they want, right? That's not even in question. But that is just like hack, and it's mostly not funny. But you're talking about political correctness as this state of no one should ever feel uncomfortable. And that could include everything from, you know, saying a joke that involves Caitlyn Jenner, but it also could involve making people feel like rightly uncomfortable about, as you say, about black people getting killed by police. That seems like those are like two different things that you're talking about, right?
Yeah. It's only an American problem. Like, people in Uganda aren't having this situation. Like,
people in Uganda are not debating PC humor? Wow.
Completely not. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, if I want to say, I can make jokes about Bill Cosby. I can't make jokes about the victims that Bill Cosby claims, you know, to have. But I can make jokes. So it's America, we have to agree on who the dumbass is and who the bad person is. I can make a joke about Kanye West if I wanted to. You know what I mean? Everybody's like, yeah, you're right, he's an asshole.
Yes.
But I can't make a joke about Taylor Swift as someone who we, quote-unquote, assume is like supposed to be like a respected leader or something, for some apparent reason, which doesn't make sense. That's not how it should work. If political correctness is that we can make fun of everybody, that's what it should be, because everyone's equal, everyone has that. But if you're saying we can't talk about certain people, regardless of hacky joke or not hacky joke, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You're saying that, oh, you can't talk about them because of whatever. Like, how often do you use, like, bad words, like offensive words?
Pretty often.
Very often, right?
Yeah.
You don't think about what you're saying.
You know.
You just know that's what you're... yeah, I know. I get it. You know, but when you say those curse words, you don't have no malicious meaning behind them unless you want to use it maliciously. But just think, just say it. That's just like a comic who has, like, this hacky gay joke. Whether it's funny or not, they're trying to come up with something.
Mm-hmm.
And to say you shouldn't try to come up with anything is obviously against the First Amendment. And also not giving them that creative spirit. They need to learn. They need to fail to succeed.
Yeah. I like that. All right. Yeah. that is, and I'm sure that this will, I'm looking forward to the IMs and the calls because I'm sure some people will disagree with it, but I really, really needed to get that perspective on. Christopher Hamilton, I really appreciate your time, man. I'll talk to you soon.
Oh, yeah, no problem, brother. Thank you for having me. Have a good one.
All right, you too. Be well. All right, everybody. We are going to get into the, yes, Kelly? Yes? Yes.
Well, I just had a thought about the discussion that you just had.
Could we save it for the fun half? Tell me as soon as we get there.
Yes, I would love to.
Awesome. Okay. Everybody, we're going to go into the fun half. The IMs are open. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. I'll open up the phone lines over the break. As you know, this show exists because you support it. Become a member today at majority.fm/member. Less than a cup of coffee a day to support and sustain fully independent media and really a successful small business, which is actually kind of crazy to think of it that way, but that's what it is. Go to justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee today. Get the Majority Report blend. That is a win for everybody. It's a win for the workers, a win for the environment, a win for a great company, and a win for the Majority Report. If you're going to go shop at Amazon, which is, of course, the absolute opposite of justcoffee.coop, what you can do is you can skim a touch of money off of Jeff Bezos by using the Majority Report link to make your Amazon purchases, and that helps too. It's like pizza slices, folks. Every little bit helps. We'll be right back on the fun half of the Majority Report. We'll take your calls and IMs. I'm calling into the system right now.